I think the legal definition of consent is not helpful for young people. And even the idea of the age of consent is not particularly helpful. It's like we teach it in this way of, for your 16th birthday, you're not going to be ready, but you're going to blow the candles out in your cake and boom, you're ready and you're fine. And nobody's going to exploit you and nobody's going to force you into doing things you don't want to because you're 16 now. I kind of think the age of consent is a bit of a moot point. It's not the key bit of information that young people need.
Consent is a tricky concept. In previous episodes, we've looked at how and why consent continues to be central to how we think, talk about, and legislate sex. In doing so, we also explored the ways in which consent isn't really working for us, and is vulnerable to problematic narratives about sex, about who wants it, who should have it, and what good sex looks like, that do not match up with many people's lived realities. In this follow-up episode, we will explore some different stories we could be telling about sex, and what happy, healthy, and ethical sex should be. My name is Amrita Olawale McMedis, and this is The Age of Consent. So we'll start by speaking to Dr. Laura Lummers-Nyemi, a legal historian at the University of Warwick, and the reason why this podcast came about in the first place. Since the initial run of episodes of The Age of Consent, Laura has been working on a book about the history of sexual consent. We asked Laura about how the podcast has developed her work and what she felt were the key themes that emerged.
The podcast series was such a good journey in many ways, and so many interesting things and themes came out of the podcast series. I'm really glad so many people felt like sharing their work and sharing their thoughts and their feelings about sexual consent for the podcast series. I think for me, one of the key things that emerged from the series was really that unsensible uncertainty that people felt around the concept of sexual consent. Absolutely everyone you spoke to expressed some issues around the very idea of consent as we know it and as we use it today. Almost everyone accepted that consent was a flawed concept and something that doesn't always work as a benchmark, at least. Legally speaking, it seems that for most people, consent was good enough. But at the same time, most people felt that it's not good enough when it comes to real life practices, or particularly when it comes to actually thinking about sexual ethics. In one of the earlier, if not the very first episode, we had a guest, Gwen Seaborn, who was a wonderful legal historian. And she said something in the lines of, well, consent is the bare minimum. The very least you can do is to make sure that your sexual partner is consenting to things that you're doing. And I couldn't agree with her more. And I think this really sort of got us thinking about ethical sex and that we need something more than just consent for when it comes to ethical sex. I'm also really glad we had the chance to do this final bonus episode and dig a little bit deeper into what that might look like in practice and how our future generation prepared to navigate these complexities of sex and ethics.
So what are different ways we could be talking about sex and consent? We spoke to Johnny Hunt, who works directly with children and young people and speaks to them about sex and relationships. Johnny is also a lecturer in applied social sciences at the University of Bedfordshire and has written a book for adults called Sex Ed for Grown-Ups. Johnny spoke to us about the gendered way we teach children and young people about consent and why it is so important to reflect on this.
Consent, how it's taught in school quite often, it's taught from this legal perspective that until you're 16, you can't consent because you don't have capacity, really simple. And if somebody says stop or no, then you have to stop. That's the rules. And that's kind of how it's taught, especially to young men, in this kind of idea of if somebody says stop or no, you have to stop because otherwise that's assault and you're doing something wrong. That is a message for boys. Whereas like when we talk about contraception, that tends to be a message for girls. The responsibility is of women to stop pregnancy, whereas there's a responsibility for boys not to get arrested, essentially, is how it's kind of sold.
Johnny believes that this isn't the best way to teach about consent and how to navigate sexuality in real life, and takes a different tack with the young people he works with. Instead, Johnny uses a more dynamic and conversational approach that focuses on the messy reality of consent, starting with how difficult it can be to say no. He gives an example of someone asking you out for a drink. If you don't want to go, you're unlikely to feel you can just say, no thanks, I don't want to. You will probably make up an excuse instead, like, I'm tired or I need to get home to feed the cat. We tend to worry about saying no and letting people down in any context, and so in the context of sex, it can be even trickier. Johnny uses stories to demonstrate how complex consent can be and what can impact being able to give consent freely.
I say, right, imagine I'm in an assembly and I've got all of year seven or whole of year eight in front of me. So I've got an assembly hall with 150 kids in, whatever it might be. And we've just talked about consent and we've talked, it's all about getting permission. And they all go, oh yeah, that makes sense. And I say, right, okay, I need three volunteers to help me with a display, with an activity on the stage. And I look around the room and I always say, this is how I kind of tell the story. I don't do this because it's non-consensual, but I tell this story. And I say, right, I always look around the room. And when you look around the room, especially when they're like year sevens, they get dead excited. And someone wave their hands up in the air and ignore them because there's no point. And then equally, there's lots of children who kind of disappear into their chair as if they're not there and they become invisible, as in, don't pick me. But most kind of teenagers will sit there in their chairs looking at you, but they'll try really hard not to make eye contact. So they'll be looking at your forehead or your ears and just making sure they don't look at you. Because if you look at them, then that's it. You're going to get picked. They're always the good ones. So you point and go, can you come to the front? And there's this moment when you point at them where they kind of go and look shocked like a rabbit in the headlights as the colour drains from their face, and then look at their friend on either side hoping you meant them, and then they realise it's them. And you can clearly see from their face that they don't want to come to the front, and yet this magical thing happens. The muscles in their legs go and they stand up and they shuffle to the end of their row, and then they walk to the front of the assembly hall as if they're going to be shocked when they get there. And then they stand on the stage with this kind of panicked look on their face as all their friends are staring at them. And so I tell that story, and then I always say to the group, so did they consent? And it's really interesting for them to unpick, because a lot of them go, well, no, because they didn't want to. I said, so why did they stand up? Why did they do it? And then somebody else will say, oh, well, they did consent because you didn't make them. And I go, oh, no, I didn't drag them by the hair, did I? And I didn't threaten them. I didn't say, if you don't come, you'll get in trouble or I'll get you excluded or whatever it might be. And it's a really interesting conversation, as they can clearly see that that person didn't want to, and they can clearly empathize why they wouldn't want to. But equally, it's trying to understand why they then did it. And so we then have this conversation and we talk about power. We talk about there's a power imbalance because I'm an adult and they're kids. We tell children from day one that children should always do as they're told by adults. And it's even worse than that, because not only am I an adult or a teacher, but I'm a guest. And when you go into schools, there's always that secretive chat before you go in about, I've got a guest coming in tomorrow. So be on your best behavior. Don't let me down. Don't let yourselves down. And don't let the school down, which raises that pressure level even higher. And so we've got this idea that young people should always do as they're told when adults tell them to, even if they don't want to. But then also we've got this other power dynamic in the room as well, is that we're in public. So there's that peer pressure sort of idea, is that I'm scared that if I say no, I don't want to, my friend will go, oh, don't be a wuss, you know, or something worse. And so even though there is nobody's making them, the power imbalance in that room means that it's not a free choice, because there's a consequence if they say no.
Johnny uses another example to illustrate the pressure that the gaze of others can exert on us by discussing a scene in Heartstopper. The scene goes like this. Nick, one of the main characters, comes out of the changing room. All of his friends are waiting for him. One of his friends, Imogen, comes up to him and asks him if he would like to go on a date with her. It's obvious that Nick is uncomfortable. As the audience, we know Nick fancies someone else and doesn't want to go out with Imogen. He is exploring his sexuality and his feelings for a boy, something he has not fully processed yet and is not ready to have people know about. But he's in front of all his friends and they are all egging him on, making it clear that they expect him to say yes. He also likes Imogen and knows she will feel embarrassed if he turns her down in front of everyone. He doesn't want to hurt her feelings. Nick doesn't want to say yes, but because of the circumstances, he does. There are lots of different pressures that make it very difficult for people to say no. And Johnny argues that the way we currently teach and model consent doesn't help young people understand their own desires and boundaries.
And so that's the kind of really interesting thing. I spend a lot of time having that conversation and go, right, now you're on a sofa, you're making out with your partner and you're really enjoying it. And then they move it forward. They might put their hand up your top or down your pants or whatever it might be. And you don't want that to happen. If I say stop now, what happens? And they're like, well, they'll stop, but that ruins the moment, doesn't it? They feel awkward and they're kind of like, oh, but does that mean you don't like me? And we have all that awkwardness because we know that saying no or stop is really important, because we keep telling young people that. But that means that you don't want to let your partner down. And sometimes it's easier to let things happen, even though you don't want to, than it is to say no. And it's that understanding about why people might actively go along with something they don't want to do, just like the imaginary person in my assembly, why they might stand up, why they might walk to the front, even though every part of their body is still saying no. And that consent is not about doing things when you don't want to. It's about actively doing them because you want to, because you enjoy it, and because you're able to say no if you chose to. And I think that's the real difference in how we should teach consent compared to the kind of no or stop and the law says this method of teaching consent, which is kind of quite often how it's done. And if you read the guidance for RSE, it is very legal focused, which doesn't give young people any of the tools they need to actually enforce that, which I think is a real shame.
Johnny covers the social aspects of why saying no can be difficult and how context, expectations, feelings, and lots of other factors can all play a part. For Johnny, there are some things that are essential for positive and constructive conversations about sex and consent. Acknowledging gender roles and stereotypes, changing the language we use, and exploring emotional literacy.
Yeah, one of the key things that comes up time and time again, I spend a lot of time talking about, is the way that we treat girls and boys differently and the messages that we give to them really, really early on. So I was doing the sessions yesterday around kind of puberty. And what's really interesting is how we shape girls and boys' knowledge. So puberty is a really interesting one, because part of puberty is teaching you about, puberty is all about getting your bodies ready for making babies. And so we teach boys that they produce sperm cells and girls produce egg cells. So we teach boys around the fact that they get erections and they ejaculate, and that might feel nice. And whilst we're giving boys very age-appropriate talks about pleasure, essentially, and orgasm, girls get a talk about periods, which is not equal. We don't teach girls the same things we teach boys. Boys get taught about wet dreams. We don't teach girls that girls have wet dreams too, and their bodies practice their sexual responses too. So boys get taught their sexual responses and girls get menstrual cramp.
So boys get a talk about orgasms and girls get a talk about period cramps. Boys get taught about pleasure and girls get taught about pain, and that doesn't seem fair. But this example of educational asymmetry is certainly not isolated. Johnny explains how the way we teach boys and girls about their anatomy also reinforces the idea that sex is about pleasure for boys and reproduction for girls.
And if you go back even earlier, when boys start primary school, most boys already have the correct name for their body parts, whereas girls tend not to start school with any names for their genitals. And if they do, it'll be a kind of a cutesy name, like a Tuppence or a Nunu or a Tinky Winky or whatever it might be, you know, or other cast members of the Teletubbies. And the reason we teach primary school children the correct names for their body parts is because it's a protection thing, is children who can name their private parts are less likely to be abused. We do the work around kind of the pants rule, and anything covered by your underwear is private. But even when we do teach girls the correct name, we teach them the word vagina, not vulva. And the vagina is about reproduction. The vulva is around what feels nice and ownership of my body. And whilst we might not want to be talking about pleasure with very small children at this age, it sets up this dialogue that sex is something for boys to enjoy and not something for girls.
We learn these messages explicitly through sex education and implicitly through language, through behaviour of those around us, and through things like media and how sex and relationships are presented to us. Johnny often uses Disney princesses to reflect on problematic narratives that we hear and where we get our ideas about sex, relationships, and gender. For example, in Frozen, Elsa is the main character and Hans, a love interest, pretends to love her because he wants something. Elsa believes him and her feelings grow. But when Elsa is in danger and needs true love's first kiss, she turns to Hans for help and he shuts her down. He doesn't actually care about her. This is a helpful example of grooming. In Beauty and the Beast, Belle falls in love with the Beast, even though he is cruel and mistreats her. Her love changes the Beast and he becomes kind, sending a message that if you love him, he will change. rhetoric often used in abusive relationships. And finally, in Sleeping Beauty, the supposedly romantic first kiss between Aurora and Prince Charming happens while Aurora is in a coma. She has never met Prince Charming and does not have capacity to consent to a kiss, but he kisses her anyway. Hardly appropriate behaviour. Johnny says these examples help unpick some of the stereotypes we hold around gendered aspects of relationships and how we think intimacy should work, and therefore are key to changing the stories we tell about sex and consent.
And so you've kind of got this message that starts really, really early on that goes all the way through. And I think that's a really important thing when we think about consent, because if you don't understand how your body works and you can't claim ownership of it, how can you consent? Because it's never going to be informed consent. It's never going to be about you. It's going to be about your partner. And obviously that's a very heteronormative sort of view, but unfortunately that's still how we talk about sex, in this very heteronormative sort of way.
So let's dig into the implications of that. Heteronormative means behaving as if being heterosexual, being sexually and romantically attracted to people of the opposite gender, is what's normal and natural. So we too often teach relationship and sex education as if everyone in the class is heterosexual, ignoring the fact that many people will not relate to this. Equally, this approach tends to force people into boxes, telling them how they are expected to behave and what norms they are expected to follow. Johnny explains how these gender stereotypes, taught to children early on, develop into firmly gendered beliefs that make it more difficult for young people to be responsive to their partner's cues.
But then equally, as we get a little bit older, we start talking about sex as being, you know, if a lad sleeps around, he's a player. And if a girl sleeps around, she's a slag or a slut. And so again, there's no ownership of female sexuality. And then when that comes to things like consent, this then plays out in the way that we've got these very strong gender roles, that the roles for men, a man's job, all boys want to have sex and all your men want to have sex. So guys should be after everything they can possibly get. And so a guy's job is to attack, is to kind of push as far as he can go, and until they say stop or no, because when they say stop or no, you have to stop. Whereas a girl's job is kind of pitched this other way, that nice girls don't do that. So we've got this attack and defense sort of narrative that kind of plays out. And it starts so early on, it's really difficult to unpick. And then when you start talking about consent, I've done whole consent shop workshop sort of thing. And at the end we go, right, so how many girls ask boys for consent? And they all kind of look about, that's not our job. That's not our role. That boys to us, girls, not the other way around. And so even though, you know, I started off talking about, you know, anatomy and pleasure, what we're really talking about is the roles, the gender roles that we have, and how that plays out and how that causes issues when it comes to things like consent, because there's no ownership for women. And there's also the assumption that their job is to defend and push and say no. So the responsibility is on women to say no, and the responsibility on young men is to push.
We too readily apply gendered and heteronormative boxes where boys play offense and girls play defense. So what does it look like when boys flirt with boys and girls flirt with girls? This is too rarely given any space. Being aware of these gendered pressures that we are placed under and that we place on each other is important and can help us to reflect on our own behaviour. One thing frequently advocated for to better teach children and young people about consent is having positive role models, having adults in children's lives who model consent in daily activities.
There has been some sort of pushback when people say, well, we should be teaching small children about consent. And it always comes back to this idea about children being able to say no to grandma sort of thing. You know, this kind of idea that if children don't want to kiss or hug their parents, then they shouldn't have to. And parents forcing that, and it's kind of misinterpreted as if what we're saying is you're not allowed to hug or show affection to your children anymore. And that's not what it's about at all. It's about adults modeling really good behaviors. It's about adults behaving like adults rather than feeling hurt that their child doesn't want to give them a cuddle today. You're a grown up, you know that sometimes we don't always want to do things, even though we still do love and care. And whereas I think a lot of adults sometimes, it's very easy to go, oh, you know, they don't want to give me a cuddle, that must mean they don't like me anymore, which is a kind of a very immature thought process, but it's really natural and normal why we might feel like that.
Johnny emphasises that this isn't to imply that parents aren't teaching consent properly or to limit how much affection parents show to their children. Rather, it is about highlighting where the logic behind our behaviours can lead and the opportunities that parents and other adults have to intervene in simple ways.
We know this already. We've been doing it for years. The example I always bring up when I talk to parents is this, crossing the road. Every adult, when they're with a small child, does this weird pantomime when they get to a road. They go, right, now stop. Now look left and look right. Hold mummy's hand. Now keep looking and listening. Can you hear anything? And we do this pantomime every single time because we know that one day that child's going to be crossing the road without us. And you create this kind of muscle memory of it just being so ingrained. Why can't we do consent exactly the same way that we just keep modeling it? You're not going to get it right every time. And yes, sometimes you do just need to go because I said so, because that's what we're like with parents. But equally, there are opportunities that you go, right, shall I help you put your coat on? Would you like me to zip it up? Or are you going to do it? Just getting in that process of trying to ask children every time before we touch them or every time we try and help them, if that's what they want. And yes, sometimes when you rush, you just go, yes, stick your coat on because we need to get in the car because we're late. But if we can do it good enough, if, you know, 7 times out of 10, we take that extra moment to go, right, which shoes are you going to wear today? Do you want me to help you? Can I lift your top off and help you get changed? Just keep asking because it models that really good behavior that before children touch other children, that they know they're supposed to ask. And it, again, it just becomes normal and natural and kind of muscle memory in that sort of way. And I think that's a really important one, is just thinking about all the opportunities that we have, especially as parents with small children, to model those sort of things.
Modelling consent can help give children the internalised knowledge, the so-called muscle memory, to understand consent. To act according to what feels right and comfortable for them, in order to understand whether they want to or don't want to do something. It can also give children the right reflexes when it comes to respecting other people's boundaries. This can be consolidated by learning to develop strong emotional literacy. Johnny explains how he encourages people to do this with children.
And it's just every time we read or watch something, get in the habit of asking the questions of, how do they feel? How do you know? What are the clues? You know, when you're people watching, when you're sat waiting for a bus or whatever it's doing, get children to people watch and tell stories about the people and try and guess how they might be feeling. It's becoming like an emotional detective of trying to spot those sort of things. And every time you read a story, asking that question of how does the character feel? How do you know? What are the clues? Because the more we can build that empathy, understanding, trying to put yourself in somebody else's shoes, and the more we can start thinking and looking for how people feel and understanding people have feelings, then that massively impacts everything going forward. But there's so many things that as parents we're already doing, but we don't connect it to consent, whereas we could do. And it's just having that in the back of your head and going, oh, I've got an opportunity to keep modelling this. Because we know that children learn by that kind of modelling.
The model of consent, as taught by Johnny, is much broader than what the law currently defines. It looks at context, social norms, expectations, and power. It includes pleasure and empathy and takes a whole community approach to learning about and enforcing the boundaries around which behaviours are acceptable and which are not. But is it possible to reflect this vision of sexuality in our laws to protect people from sexual violence and abuse? Could we imagine a justice system that takes such a holistic approach to sexuality? We spoke to Tina Sicker, reader in Technoscience and Intersectional Justice at Newcastle University, and author of Sex, Consent and Justice, a book that aims at doing exactly that, reimagining our approach to legislating sexual behaviour.
Yeah, so I talk about the problem with consent as the ideal model that undergirds our sexual ethics. You know, how malleable and tricky and sticky consent as a foundational idea is, and how much work we're asking it to do. In the book, I also talk about the amplifying effects of social media. I go over political polarization, changing relations of power and gender norms. I talk about narratives of gendered violence in a number of ways. And I really wanted to engage with all of these complications and offer a way to further the aims of Me Too as it relates to gender justice with restorative principles and case studies, and to kind of do so in a way that was rigorous, that had a lot of historical analysis and critique and world building. And so, yeah, all of that together sort of comprised the book.
Tina wrote this book to explore some of these tensions and how we can represent these complexities within a legal framework. How do we have discourse about happy and healthy sexualities and the liberating understanding of consent that Johnny talks about, while also ensuring that victims of sexual violence have access to justice? Tina saw these tensions reflected in the Me Too movement, and in exploring them through her book, she critiques the consent-based model of sexual ethics and offers a different model, one that might be better able to hold these tensions. She calls her model the pleasure and care-centered ethic of embodied and relational sexual otherness, a more complex name that seeks to reflect the complexity it is trying to maintain. Tina explains.
So in the book, I spend a lot of time unpacking what that model offers and what it entails. But in order to kind of use it as an analytic to work in the case studies, I did have to distill it down to, you know, a few principles. So some of the principles include, you know, not looking at sex as individual acts to be judged, but as an assemblage of bodies, technologies, laws, norms, and trying to engage in a wider and more contextual understanding of sex, not just whether an individual act is permissible or not permissible. I really emphasize mutual pleasure and care for the self and other. I do make room for transactional sex, so keeping a model that had space for sex work and everyday sex, say for, you know, your partner or for conception, you know, that would still fit into the model, that it would be queer in orientation. So it would cover, you know, sex that was unbounded, that was energetic, that was risky. And I think that sex is just an activity that and a process and something that is much more embodied and doesn't quite fit into the way that we categorize activities and knowledge. That communication is really important through the discussion of boundaries, for example, whether it's verbal or it's through bodily cues, that it very much centers an orientation to the other, where the other or others that you are constituting a sexual act with, that you have an obligation to them as an ethical subject. And finally, that sex is an embodied, not a solipsistic practice, that it's relational, that it's codeterminative, and that it's contextual, that it requires an accounting of unequal power relations as well. And so those are the kind of tenets that I go in and I analyze the case studies with, and then I sort of offer this as an alternative model.
So Tina identifies some key things that need to change about how we approach sex. Firstly, we should stop thinking about sex as individual disconnected acts, but rather sex needs to be understood as situated in the wider context in which it takes place. Our understanding should also be inclusive and emphasize a responsibility for communicating and caring for the people that we have sex with. We should refocus on sex as being pleasurable for everyone involved. Basically, the way we talk about, teach about, and legislate sex should connect to the real ways people have sex and help define what healthy and ethical sex should look like. But a consent-based approach is unable to adequately deliver this. Here's an example.
I mean, I would give the example. I was listening to, I think it was a radio show, and someone was on advocating a consent app for undergraduate students, where people who were going to engage in sex at the university level would bring up this app and then both sign off. And, you know, then they were able to engage in sex that was understood as being consensual. And rationally, at that particular moment, there may be an agreement But I think that sex is not an act, it's more of a process. And it's a process that is embodied. And so when you engage in sex with a co-determining other, bodily cues and understanding of, you know, do I like this? Do I not like this? That things change so quickly. And that the problem with the models that we have is sort of distilled in this technology that is meant to sort of determine, okay, in these very discrete moments, whether something is wanted or not.
From a current legal standpoint, apps like this seem to make sense. Is there consent for this act, yes or no? This appears to make things nice and clear, removing any ambiguities and misunderstandings about whether or not both parties wanted sexual intimacy. But giving consent through an app at a specific moment, and usually before sex has begun, doesn't actually help us much in establishing whether the sex is ethical or even legal. What if someone consents at first, but changes their mind? What if they consent to one type of intimacy but not another, or initially agree to an act but subsequently realize they don't enjoy it and want to withdraw consent for this specific act? What if they are coerced into signing off their consent on the app? Apps like this seem to make sense on paper, but they follow a transactional and simplistic consent-based model, and are a good example of how this fails to encapsulate a rich understanding of human sexualities. So we clearly need a new approach to understanding and talking about what sex should be. But what about how we approach it in our legal systems? Isn't one of the reasons we're stuck with consent because it's the best tool we have for defining what illegal, harmful sex looks like and for seeking justice? Tina has explored this question, looking at how restorative justice could provide an alternative.
I argue for a restorative and more of an approach that is about reconciliation rather than being punitive. So, you know, just looking at the criminal injustice system as it is, you know, looking at clear up rates or outcomes or recidivism, survivors' satisfaction, that it does very, very poorly. And that I think that we really need to push the boundaries of what we consider justice to look like. And that a restorative approach sort of that is based in some of the work that's being done in Canada and Australia, in the States as well, in New Zealand, that is inspired by some Indigenous models where you have members of the community, the perpetrator, the survivor, community members, family members that together determine appropriate responses to crime.
Restorative justice is a process within which the parties involved in an offence collectively resolve how to deal with the aftermath. It can either involve direct contact between victims and offenders or indirect communication via third parties, and it centres what victims need from the process. In contrast to an adversarial system of prosecuting rape, which focuses on punishing perpetrators for breaking the law, the idea behind restorative justice is to focus on the harm that has been caused and how perpetrators can take responsibility and what victims need to heal.
It's about restoring a community back to wholeness. And so the focus is really on repair for the survivor, for the perpetrator, particularly if it's a family member or someone who's part of the victim's or the victim survivor's life. Also accountability, and that there is a premise that the perpetrator, the accused, confesses. And that's something that is not possible in an adversarial system.
If done properly, it is a long, tailored process of restitution. However, as Tina outlines, these pilot programs are just that. They are pilot programs. They aim to understand the potential for a restorative approach and what would be required in order for this to work. One key consideration is how this could be implemented in a way that would be robust enough to not become an easy way out for perpetrators. If improperly implemented, this approach has the potential to put survivors and communities at risk of re-victimization and further harm. Tina's work is ongoing, and her next steps will be to explore how victim survivors feel about her proposed model of sexual ethics, and to explore their views and concerns about restorative justice.
I'm now trying to engage in getting some grant funding to do some creative practice workshops around introducing this model, particularly with survivors, to understand whether this model of sexual ethics is something that they consider important or significant or relevant, or whether the consent model is something that they're more comfortable with. And also when it comes to restorative justice. So then, you know, making steps to have survivors involved in the process, because that centering of lived experience is something that I think is really important.
Tina's model of sexual ethics, combined with restorative justice principles, explore an alternative to consent-based legislation by seeking to include the complexities of human sexualities. Center survivor healing and hold perpetrators accountable, it provides one example of what a different sexual justice framework could look like. It's clear that any approaches to improving access to justice and the ethics of sex and relationships more generally need to take into account real complexities in order to work. But it's also clear that there are many aspects that we are yet to work out. We asked Laura what she thought were the key things that we're still grappling with.
This is actually a very complicated question, because I think we are in many ways grappling with all of it. We are still grappling with issues with capacity, for sure. When it comes to young people, thinking about sexual maturity and young people's ability to consent to sex with other young people or sex with older people, we are grappling with power relations at workplaces, in different institutions. We are definitely grappling with sexual identities and gender identities, and also sexual histories and how those might impact our ability to consent and consent to what kind of sex as well. And I think we are certainly grappling with legal boundaries and those gray areas between criminal and unethical behavior. And in some ways, following the Me Too movement, I think there might be even more questions than there are answers to all of these things that we are still grappling with. But I don't necessarily think that is a bad thing. And the sense of uncertainty is not necessarily a bad thing, because grappling with and debating these difficult questions is necessary, and it's necessary to move the boundaries of acceptable behavior and think about those boundaries, and also necessary to move the conversation on to somewhere hopefully more fruitful in the future.
So what would you like to see from this work in the future? How would you like to see conversations about sex move on?
For me, one of the most powerful statements of all of this podcast series on Age of Consent has been this interview that you did with Tania Serisier and the discussion in the episode 5. In that discussion, she spoke about what do we want from the future. And she asked in the episode, are we imagining a world without rape, or are we imagining a world where every rapist is locked up? And that is such a provocative and powerful question. And of course, ultimately, what we would want is a world without rape, without sexual violence, without coercion. So what I think I would like from this work is that it moves on beyond thinking about law, beyond thinking about criminal liability and criminal justice, and just into these everyday discussions around ethical sex and the promise of ethical sex, so that the future might look a little bit brighter than today, and certainly brighter than what the past looked like.
This series is focused on consent. Where it's come from, the role it plays in law, and how it interacts with problematic norms about sex and gender, with far-reaching consequences, from how we teach young people about sex to how we seek justice for victims of rape and sexual violence. We've also seen how, in practice, the way we implement consent is often disconnected from the messy realities of real sex. But we could do better. We could think more deeply about the narratives we pass on about what positive and healthy relationships should look like, the importance of emotional literacy and being attentive to what other people are feeling, and modeling good behavior. In cases of rape and harm, we could make more space in our justice system for accountability and healing. We could refocus on our responsibility to care for our sexual partners, how sex should be pleasurable for everyone involved in it, and what happy ethical sex should be. This has been a bonus episode of The Age of Consent, a podcast by Narrative Matters, written and produced by me, Amrita Oluwole McMedis, and Gabrielle Blackburn. We would like to thank Laura Lamasyemi, Johnny Hunt, and Tina Sicker for taking part in these interviews. Johnny's book, Sex Ed for Grown-Ups, is available to buy, and you can follow Johnny on X, formerly Twitter, at Little Rubber Hat. Tina's book, Sex, Consent, and Justice, A New Feminist Framework, is also available to buy, and you can follow Tina at tsicker. The series was commissioned by Dr. Laura Lamasyemi and was funded by a Connecting Cultures Award from the University of Warwick. You can follow Laura at L. Lamasyemi. The music in this episode is the Victorian Music Lullaby Song from Iron LPL. To access support, you can call the National Rape Crisis Helpline at 0808 802 9999.